The New Hampshire State Legislature is a full docket of interesting legislation. Professor Bashir joins me to discuss. This is the UNH Law Podcast. Learn more about the law school and apply by visiting law.unh.edu. Opinions discussed are solely the opinion of the faculty or host and do not constitute legal advice or necessarily represent the official views of the University of New Hampshire. So, Buzz, yeah, it was really, we were originally going to do fair chance hiring, and then we went, oh, we did that already. Maybe we should see what else. But you, and then you said, oh, there's a whole bunch of interesting things going through the legislature. So I figured I'd agree with you. It'd be awesome to review it.
So let me start with fair chance hiring, yeah, which is sometimes known as ban the box legislation. The idea is to take the box on private and public employment applications that is there that asks you the question, check this box if you have a criminal conviction for which you haven't been pardoned or for which you haven't received an annulment. And you see that on many, many, many employment applications.
Which, in theory, you could just be immediately knocked off because they don't even want to bother with you.
Yeah, yeah. You know, the concern is that people just throw in the trash can all those who've checked the box. The other theory is, and all this is somewhat hard to prove with data for a whole bunch of reasons, is many people with criminal convictions, when they see the box, they just throw out the application. They don't apply because they believe, correctly or not, that they won't get hired.
Right.
So in conjunction with the ACLU of New Hampshire, I drafted a bill to take the box off the employment application, either public or private. And delay when employers can find out whether the people that they're considering hiring their applicants have criminal convictions. And it delays it until their interview. They are allowed to ask the question at the interview, have you been convicted of a crime for which you haven't been pardoned or you haven't received an annulment? They can also, once the interview is done, do a criminal record check. All the legislation does is prohibit them from doing any earlier than that. The idea being employers are going to have a better context within which to make a judgment whether this person is someone they want to hire in spite of the criminal conviction. If they have selected this person out of a pool of applicants based on what their resume says about their skill set. Then they get to the interview and then they ask the question. If it's done, then they see, okay, this person 10 years ago in college had a possession of marijuana conviction. You know, given the skill set he or she is offering, I'm still going to hire them.
Yeah, taking consideration the laws change, morals change of
exactly
how the government handles things. Yeah.
And, you know, I think our intuitive sense is that I think it's right that when people see the box checked on an application, they don't say, oh, this is probably a marijuana conviction. They are more inclined to think, oh, this is a first-degree murder conviction or a violent crime of some sort. And it scares them, right, understandably. The effect of the legislation is twofold. It puts an employer's consideration of a potential employee in a better context for decision. Number two, it increases the chances that people who are trying to reenter society after having served their sentence, paid their restitution, paid their fines, can reintegrate. The two single most important factors in successful reintegration and a lack of recidivism is one, housing, and two, a job.
Now, we talked about in the previous episode where we went a little more in depth on fair chance hiring, which I'll put a link to that episode in the episode description. I would definitely suggest checking that out if you want to get more in the weeds of it. We also talked about the, there's licensing that the state does,
yep,
that would require that. Is that involved in the legislation?
It's not involved in legislation. We are going to be working on that this summer and coming up with I have a law student working on that this summer. I've already been working on it, and we're going to come up with a draft of ways to regularize what happens in the occupational licensing world, where there are at least 45 to 50 boards that issue certifications or licenses for various professions, and they are all over the place in terms of how and if they ask the question and what the requirements are, whether you can have any kind of conviction for a license. So we're going to, that's next year's project.
Now, how has this been received? Because I'd imagine this could be a little messy.
Well, we did our groundwork. We talked to the Manchester Chamber of Commerce, the Concord Chamber of Commerce, the Executive Committee of the Business and Industry Association, fondly known as the BIA. We talked to the Department of Corrections, the Department of Labor, the Department of Employment Security. We talked to any number of senators and representatives. And there's been really broad bipartisan support. This made its way through we testified in front of the Senate Judiciary Committee. They unanimously approved it, and then it made it through the Senate on a significant majority vote. 2 days ago, on Wednesday, I testified in front of the House Labor Committee about the bill has now made its way to the House. It seemed to go very well. Good questions. There doesn't seem to be any substantial problem with it. There may be an amendment tweaking it here and there as legislators are wont to do, but I think it's in good shape.
You expect some certain jobs to maybe get a little feedback that gets an amendment?
Yeah, there are some concerns about...
To imagine dealing with children and things like that
raise an issue. Yeah, well, the legislation says, you know, if federal or state law mandates that you not hire someone with this kind of criminal conviction, mm-hmm. Then you can ask it on the application, which makes sense. Mm-hmm. So by and large, you know, I think it's going well so far, knock on wood. In terms of bail reform, last year, I think we talked several months ago or maybe last year about the comprehensive bail reform that I authored and worked with the ACLU to get through the legislature.
Which you talked about in the last episode, actually, 2 weeks ago.
Yeah, it's been very successful.
Yeah,
the jails are emptying. Mm-hmm. And so there was a bail commission and they recommended some tweaks to it. And we went in front of the legislature and the police are not as supportive as others are about this. They tend to come up with anecdotes that suggest the world is about to end because of the bail reform statute. I'm being mildly sarcastic.
I can look at the Twitter comments from the last episode as a point of reference too.
We can, but you know, I think the legislature is living very carefully, and we've gathered data to show what the actual data-driven effect of it is, and we've gotten a good response. It's made it through the Senate and the House Criminal Justice and Public Safety Committee unanimously voted in favor of that which passed the Senate already. So it will be going to the floor of the House probably in the next 2 or 3 weeks.
What sort of tweaks were done to it?
There used to be a set of factors as the non-exclusive factors that the judge could consider in deciding whether somebody was dangerous. There's clear and convincing evidence that they were dangerous and therefore they could hold them without any bail. The bail commission voted to just get rid of the factors because judges were over focusing on the individual factors. It was not a comprehensive list. It was actually a list that was a relic of the prior legislation. So we got rid of that. We made a rebuttable presumption that alleged victims did not have to testify at dangerousness hearings. And we said things like if you have had 3 failures to appear in the last 5 years, then there's a rebuttable presumption that you don't get bail. Mm-hmm. So we small but important stuff. And the legislation also renews the bail commission. So there'll be an ongoing group of people who are checking out how it's going, and do we need some more tweaks?
That'd be especially important with something like this, where a lot of it is anecdotal for both sides, where, see, this person got out and he did this horrible thing, or she did this horrible thing, and it makes for really strong news stories or arguments against it, when really looking at the numbers, it seems like it's doing good.
One out of 1,000 people.
Yeah.
And that's what we're working on. I had gathered some anecdotes, some moderate data from the court system that suggested that there was no increase in failures to appear and that the crime rate had not gone up, but we need to do more substantial work in that area. So that's what's happening in bail reform. It's made good progress throughout. It's through the Senate. It will be then. I think it'll go to the House floor shortly, likely get approved by the House, and then it's going to be up to the governor.
Yeah, and this transitions directly in probably the Office of Cost Containment.
Office of Cost Containment hasn't been looked at in many years. It's the office that collects money from people, poor people who've been appointed lawyers because they're poor. And the goal is to collect money from these poor people to pay for the lawyer that they got because they were poor.
Yeah.
What I like to call the oxymoronic state agency. And we've made some notable tweaks to that statute. We've said people who are found not guilty on all charges or had all their charges dismissed, you don't get to collect money to pay back the state for their lawyer. It just seems to be morally unfair to charge somebody, have it turn out not to be a good charge, and then charge them for the lawyer.
Right. It's not justifiable.
They had no control over whether they got charged.
Right.
And then we've tried to move the decision as to whether a person has the ability to pay back OCC to the sentencing hearing rather than the front end of the case where it is now, so that the judge is considering at the time he or she is considering fines and restitution, other impositions of monetary assessments. They're thinking about the monetary assessment called paying the state back for your lawyer at the same time. It just makes sense to do that. So that made it through the Senate on a voice vote. It's now before the House Judiciary Committee. It's now from the House Judiciary Committee. They are going to have an executive session in the next couple of weeks on that, or maybe next week on that.
Does the House seem pretty for it too?
Or the interesting thing is in the House Judiciary Committee, what we heard from some was, why the hell do we do this? Excuse my language, but why the hell do we do this at all? Shouldn't we just get rid of OCC? Office of Cost mm-hmm. Containment. So there was a very robust discussion at the hearing. The oddness of trying to collect money from poor people because they are appointed lawyers because they're poor. You know, there was some robust discussion in the committee about just abolishing it. I don't think that's not going to happen this year, but we'll see how these changes go. And the last one is a bill that has started out large and has been being trimmed down for good reason. It's a major piece of privacy legislation that is, if an item, a physical item, is abandoned, you still have a property interest in any personal and private information in that abandoned item. So that if you go to Starbucks and you leave your coffee cup there and the police follow you around and take that coffee cup, they can take the coffee cup without a problem, but they cannot mine the coffee cup for your DNA without getting a search warrant.
Interesting. Now, this what's funny about this is, especially over the last few years, we've been so focused on digital privacy that it's
this
going way back, sort of, to privacy from the 90s.
Old-fashioned, such as it is, genetic privacy.
Right.
Which is not as publicly discussed an item as a type of privacy as digital privacy.
Right.
There's a lot more, for lack of a better word, sex appeal to digital privacy than genetic privacy.
It also affects a lot less people, necessarily. It's not the entire population that's necessarily going to be investigated by the...
Well,
like
in theory, the police... The other piece of the legislation said, one, you can't do that kind of collection unless you have a warrant or exception to a warrant. And two, if you legitimately come into possession as the government of somebody's DNA, you don't get, once you're done using it for the purpose you collected it for, you don't get to hold on to it in a in a non-statutorily regulated database going forward to do with it whatever you want to.
Interesting.
You've got to get rid of it.
So how about this? What if someone's found guilty of something heinous and they're convicted? In that situation, would they be able to hold on to the DNA
Is a statute in New Hampshire and every state in the country, and federal statute, it varies from state to state, that says, depending on what crime you are convicted of, you have a statutory obligation to give a sample of your DNA through a swab of the inside of your mouth to the government, and they create a genetic profile and they put it in a database. These are what I call statutory genetic databases. Those statutory genetic databases are constitutional, and they're very tightly regulated. You can only use what's in the database for a very, very narrow set of purposes, and it's a misdemeanor crime to use it for other purposes. The problem that we're seeing around the country is counties and cities collecting data that doesn't qualify for the statutory genetic database because the people haven't been convicted of the crime, and just putting it in what I call a rogue database. There's a practice that the New York Police Department engages in that is, I'm trying to remember the name of it, and it skips my mind, that was in Newsweek recently. They just going door to door and saying, hey, you mind spitting in this cup so we can create a profile of your DNA? And they're putting all that DNA in a database.
Oh, God.
Just for future as yet unknown investigation.
Oh, so illegal.
And so, it's not illegal currently.
No, that is crazy.
Yeah, and this statute has the second provision in this proposed statute, which I wrote, is to prevent those kind of databases.
Yeah. Were they forcing people to do it? No, it's still. Ooh.
Yeah. Well, there's a fun newspaper article that I often talk about when I lecture in this area of the phenomena of genetic genealogists, people who go around and put aside Bear Brook, who go around and use DNA testing to see who's related to who.
Mm-hmm.
And they're trying to fill in their family tree. And this woman, it was an article in the New York Times of many years ago, this woman felt that this guy, she had identified this guy as the likely second cousin of her great uncle. It was the last person she needed to fill in her family, huge family database. So she walks up to him. He's washing his car in his driveway. She walks up to him out of the blue. He doesn't know her from Adam or Eve. And she says to him, hey, I think you're my second cousin related to my great uncle. Can I have a sample of your a saliva sample from you so I can run your DNA? So what are the chances that you would agree if someone walked up to you cold and asked you that question?
No.
So it's really interesting stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, you can the police traditionally use DNA and look at, you know, 13 or 23 particular genetic locations to determine, to create a little profile. They look at genetic locations which don't code for anything. It's not the genetic code location for eye color or anything like that. They've been tested and validated in that way. And that's one thing. That's a genetic profile. But they hold on to the sample. They can mine your DNA for all sorts of genetic information. And particularly, the point of this statute and why I wrote it and why I think there's a good bit of support for it is it's time that we start thinking about, do we want the government to be able to collect our DNA whenever they want to without a constitutional control?
Yeah.
This statute is designed to deal with that particular set of issues I just talked about, but it was written in light of the new Part 1, Article 2B of the New Hampshire Constitution that guarantees a right to privacy in one's personal and private information, which it got passed last session by 81% of the populace. And that very much lays down a marker about, wait a minute, Facebook, Google, the police, you know, 23andMe.
Yeah, it's proliferated.
Our information is all over the place. Let's lay down a marker that it's constitutionally important to us. The Fourth Amendment and the New Hampshire equivalent do not really talk explicitly about personal and private information. They talk about physical objects. So the point of Part 1, Article 2B was to make it more clear the importance in New Hampshire of that particular of privacy in that particular area, that is personal and private information. So this abandoned materials proposed statute is a child of Part 1, Article 2B.
Thanks for listening to the UNH Law Podcast. Learn more about us by visiting law.unh.edu or following UNH Law on social media. Be sure to comment and subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or Spotify.
Opinions discussed are solely the opinion of the faculty or host and do not constitute legal advice or necessarily represent the official views of the University of New Hampshire.